So, good evening, everybody. It's very nice to be here to celebrate the Law Department's centenary, and indeed to be able to celebrate a double centenary, or we could even say a triple centenary, because, of course, we are 100 years away not only from the foundation of this department, but also of the at least partial arrival of suffrage, of the vote for women. And then the following year, perhaps equally important for us women lawyers, we have a piece of legislation, the Sex Disqualification Removal Act, which finally takes away formal access to the professions and the civil service for women. So here I've got a slide with just a very basic timeline of some of the really key legislative changes to women over the last 100 years. Of course, we should remember that the movement for women's rights, for women's equality, goes back well before the suffrage in 1918. 1870, one of the landmarks, the Married Women's Property Act. But, of course, then, since the suffrage, we have a whole series of important legislative developments. Opening the access to the professions, then Law of Property Act, which opened up equal inheritance rights. Equal franchise finally came 10 years later when all women got the vote, irrespective of the property qualification. An even greater acceleration, really, of the extension of women's rights, the change in women's legal standing after the Second World War, with a further Married Women's Property Act, the Abortion Act in 1967. 1970, we got the Equal Pay Act, extension of divorce in 1973, and then finally a Sex Discrimination Act in 75. Changes to the law on domestic violence and further equal pay, maternity pay provisions. And then, as a criminal lawyer, one I can't possibly leave out, 1991, the House of Lords finally abolishes the marital rape exemption as a sort of outdated piece of injustice to women. And that, in a way, is one of the final formal marks of women's unequal status that was left in the law. Of course, those legal changes have come alongside some incredibly important social changes, some of them driven by law, and I'll be coming back to that point, and some of them driven by broader kinds of social change in the political and economic sphere. So here is a chart that shows the female labour force participation as a percentage of the female working age population in this country from the middle of the 19th century up to the beginning of the 21st century. And as you'll see, there is quite a sharp rise in the middle of the 19th century, increase in women's labour force participation. And then what's interesting is nothing much really happens. So despite the fact that we've got all those statutory changes that we saw on the previous slide, actually it really isn't until after the Second World War that we start to see a real change in women's behaviour in the labour market, and particularly from the 1960s on, really right up to the present day, we see rapidly increasing share of the labour force taken up by women, and a very high comparatively participation rate. Close to our hearts in a university like the LSE, of course, we're also interested in what's happened to women in higher education. And here the picture is really also very, very dramatic. If we look first at first degrees, we'll see that in 1920, just after the suffrage, women are still they're only a quarter of those taking degrees, and similarly a small proportion of those taking higher degrees. And again, it changes quite slowly. The big changes come really from the 60s, the 70s, similar pattern actually to the labour market participation. But look what's happened just in the last decade, quite extraordinary, with women decisively overtaking men at the undergraduate level and just overtaking men at the in terms of numbers at the higher degree level. So a really incredible social change here. It's very rare that you see social changes of that magnitude happen so quickly, which is, of course, makes them so interesting for any social scientist, let alone any feminist, of course. So let's zoom in on what's actually been happening to women in the law department at LSE. And here, with great thanks to Simone Davis and Maria David, who helped put these figures together and these lovely charts. Here we have what's happened to undergraduates studying law at LSE. And you can see we start from zero at the foundation. And it really bumps along the bottom again until after the war. Then it climbs really quite steadily. And then mirroring that change over the last sort of 15, 20 years in women's participation in higher education. Women overtake men in about 1990 and remain a higher number of our law students than men are. So really quite a dramatic pattern there. If we look at the LLM, it's actually a very similar sort of shaped curve, if you like. Nothing really happening here until the 1970s, and then very steady increase up to, again, higher participation among our students than today, than men. Not very much difference now between PhD level. We shouldn't read too much into these figures because we're talking about very small numbers, but you can see, again, the trend is broadly comparable. So, of course, those are just blunt numbers, but they disguise some absolutely fantastic particularities of amazing women who have passed through this department. So there's the total picture of women studying law at LSE. Let's have a look now at some of the really fascinating and high-achieving women who have been educated here and have been part of our faculty. Some of you may not know Dana Dennis-Smith. She was actually not a law student here at LSE, she was a history student. And she has set up this absolutely wonderful free website and organisation called The First 100 Years, which is really celebrating 100 years of women in the legal profession. And there are 100 women that are ultimately going to be represented on this website, and four of them are closely associated with the LSE. Dana herself, who is saying here, really interesting to be called a pioneer. They're going to be not just on the website, not just photographs, but little taped interviews. So it's a really great resource if you're interested in women's legal achievements in the 20th century. Here is one of our very most distinguished alumna, Dame Linda Dobbs, who read law here and became the first non-white High Court judge. She's now retired and does a lot of incredibly important work, charitable volunteer work. And here she is talks in her interview about how it can feel quite lonely on the bench as a woman, and you don't feel you're one of the chaps. Then Dame Rosalind Higgins would be well known to many of you. Of course, was our distinguished professor of international law and then went on to the International Court of Justice, where she's saying here that she was very often asked whether it was awkward being the first and only woman. And then Cherie Booth, QC, again will be well known to many of you and has been a very generous alumna and friend to the LSE in many ways. And Baroness Shami Chakrabarti, who has gone on specifically in her political life to focus her efforts very much on women, writing a book on that topic last year. Shami is a visiting professor here, is a very loyal and regular attender of the law department, speaks often at our events, and is one of our, again, one of our most distinguished alumna. Of course, there are just, there have been so many wonderful women associated with the department, it's hard to know where to begin and end, but I just had to show you a few more. In the middle, Olive Stone, who really was the pioneer. She was the only woman in the department for quite a long time, a very distinguished family lawyer, where she was a reader when she retired. Then to the top right-hand side, you'll see Carol Harlow, who many of you will know, our very distinguished ex-professor of public law, still teaching in the department and still very regularly in the department. And then somebody I remember very fondly, she's no longer at LSE, but Jenny Temkin on the top left-hand corner. I got to know at the very beginning of my career, my first job was at UCL, and I used to come to LSE for meetings of the Women Law Teachers Group, which Jenny and others founded. I remember when I first came to LSE myself, it took me a very long time to get here, I'm afraid, because although I always wanted to come to LSE as a student, my school thought that it was a very dangerous place. So although I did manage to get myself to London, I went to UCL, which they regarded as a safer place. I'm not quite sure why. But anyway, from my base at UCL, my first job in the early 1980s, I got to know Jenny and her colleagues, and I used to come quite regularly for Saturday morning meetings of this network in what I described at a book launch when I finally did get to LSE in 1998 as a room in the basement of the old building. My colleague Joe Jacob at that time immediately said, "Nikki, there isn't a basement in the old building, but I can tell you that that room felt as though it was a basement," and actually Joe was wrong because the ladies' loo is in the basement. Then if we go to the bottom of the slide, we'll see two colleagues, sadly late colleagues, who are wonderful contributors to this department. On the left, we've got Deborah Cass, who was a real pioneer of the field of international economic law. And then on the right, Helen Rees, a very distinguished family lawyer and well known for her feminist work. So, LSE is a wonderful place to work, and it's a wonderful place also to think about law and gender and the achievements of women over the last 100 years. And I want to just reflect a little bit on those changes and why it's so interesting to think about them and have the opportunity to work on them at the LSE. So obviously, you know, this is something I care about a great deal, personally and politically, and it's good to be able to show that some things have really changed. And here's an amazing one, really, when you think that women literally 100 years ago today could not practice as solicitors. And look where we are now. We are essentially have parity with men. There have even been times when we have more, when there have been more practicing solicitors who are female than male. But it's broadly very, very similar. Of course, this similarity masks a lot of differences because you have more men in the more high prestige and high earning parts of the profession. Nonetheless, it's an amazing achievement and we should celebrate it. But of course, other things haven't changed, or they haven't changed as much as we would like them to change, or they haven't changed in the ways we might have expected them to change. So here's just to take one, that last point first, here's one that is of particular interest to me as a criminal lawyer and somebody interested in criminology. The social standing and legal standing and social habits of women have just changed so enormously during the last 100 years. If we look at the theories of why crime levels change, why people get led into crime or why people refrain from crime, on any of the most plausible theories, I think you would have expected to see quite a big change in women's behaviour in that area. Two most obvious reasons would be that women have far more opportunities and they are perhaps less adequately socially controlled than they were, less fully disciplined in a way than they were, say, at the beginning of the 20th century. But look here, actually what's happened is that women have gone down as a proportion of offenders for the more serious indictable offences. Now, of course, this is driven by an awful lot of things, including overall levels of offending. But it is nonetheless, I think, very fascinating that, and I think really suggests that certain kinds of very gendered, informal versions of social control are still operating very powerfully for women, and perhaps more powerfully than they do for men. But let's have a look at some more standard indices of female achievement. After all, we can probably celebrate that women haven't got more active despite their increased opportunities in the criminal sphere. We would certainly, I'm sure, like to see more women in Parliament. And again, just very interesting the way the curve here follows something of the same pattern as those curves we looked at earlier in terms of labour market participation and higher education, which is to say nothing much is happening really, well, here, not really, until the 1990s, incredibly slow pace of change. In 1992, we still have fewer than 10% women MPs in this country. Then it leaps up with, of course, Labour's all-women shortlist policy, and then it improves again, interestingly, in 2017. And I think it's very interesting to see that big leap that the all-women shortlist produced has been sustained, because sometimes people say, well, you don't get anywhere with quotas and targets, because if the underlying dynamics haven't shifted, then that will continue to, the differences will continue to recreate themselves. But that doesn't seem to have been the case with MPs, and so that policy of Labour's has really had a very lasting effect on women's political participation in this country. Alas, however, the gender pay gap remains with us, and particularly in the private sector, remains really quite substantial, despite the best efforts of the Women's Budget Group, from whom I've taken this data. And you'll see a lot more on this if you're interested in our Gender Inequality and Power Commission report, which I'll give the link to on the final slide, on which we worked across departments, economists, sociologists, social policy scholars, lawyers, political scientists, gender studies colleagues, to look generally at the position of women in early 21st century Britain. So this is another set of figures on the gender pay gap, again showing really the same data in a slightly different way. Now let's go back to the legal profession, and here we have data about judges. We see a sort of clustering of achievement here. If I were to show you a chart for tribunals, you'll see that women are pretty well represented among tribunal participants. But here you see the familiar pattern. We now have 3 of 12 Supreme Court justices as women, but that 24, basically a quarter ratio persists through all the higher courts, and it really isn't until you get down to the magistrates' courts and district courts that you see a higher proportion. Similar pattern with barristers, and the QC figures really matter, of course, for the judiciary, because despite the diversification of access to the judiciary somewhat, it remains really dominated by barristers and by senior barristers. And so the fact that despite various reforms, we remain with a really, really small, disappointingly small proportion of women QCs is really a problem in terms of tackling those figures in terms of the judiciary. So we might want to ask ourselves, how long is too long to wait in our suffrage colours of purple and green up there? And I had to put this slide on, wonderful biography of a pioneering American Californian woman lawyer, Clara Schultz, by our colleague Barbara Babcock from Stanford Law School. What a fabulous dress. It shows that women lawyers can be professionally successful and extremely elegant. So just to remind ourselves how long this has been going on, the first woman law graduate in this country graduated from UCL, which was the first university to admit people irrespective of gender, religion, whatever. 1888, it's a long time ago. It was then not till 1920 that the first solicitor, female solicitor, was admitted, first female barrister, a couple of years later in 22. This year, the number of women entering law degree programs has outnumbered men by 2 to 1. What an extraordinary social change in that time. So a story of incredible achievement, and we're so proud at the LSE to have been a big part of that. Why is it so special to research law and gender, to think about these issues at LSE? Well, of course, the great thing about our department is we are nested in this very powerful social science university, which is based on the motto, on its mission, is to help us understand, to work on the understanding of the causes of things. And that's why I love to work here, because I want to understand these differences. And these differences are not, of course, autonomous legal differences. They are being driven by a whole number of different social vectors, dynamics, kinds of power. And in particular, I think it's exciting to work on law in a social science university, because it helps us to understand both what is the distinctive, special contribution of the law in shaping social, political, and economic institutions and in driving change over time, but also on the ways in which those legal dynamics interact with and, you know, shape and are shaped by economic, political, and cultural dynamics. So I think that's just so important for understanding the scope for overcoming the remaining barriers to gender equality and justice. So I'll leave you with just a few further resources that you might find interesting. The First 100 Years, Dana's wonderful website, our own Law Centenary, People and Timeline on our website, the LSE's Commission on Gender Inequality and Power, which has lots of further resources available on the Gender Department, Gender Studies Department's website, and another podcast of our wonderful event with Baroness Hale and Baroness Chakrabarti earlier this year. Thank you.